friends, and welcome to the Universal Sisterhood podcast. We're hoping to create a place where women can delve deeper, lift their gaze higher, live freer, laugh louder, smile brighter, and be the authentic woman she was designed to be. Every human heart has been created to be seen, known, and loved. So this is the place where women can share their story. Welcome to episode 102. In today's episode, I chat with Lorraine Bennett. She has co-authored many books with her husband, Art, but today we're chatting about her book that she wrote by herself, The Little Way of Living with Less, Learning to Let Go with the Little Flower. This book was inspired by her personal journey of letting go and realizing that less is actually more. This book highlights our own need to re-examine our relationship with the things we keep and how to navigate living with less. Our conversation is light and funny, and I'm sure you'll learn a few tricks of letting go along the way. Before we dive into the conversation, I would love to remind you that registrations are open for the Arise Retreat this September at St. Finbar's Parish in Glenbrook. The link to the tribe booking will be in the show notes, along with all the other links to Lorraine's books. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, consider sharing it with a friend. Have a lovely day. Welcome to the podcast today, Lorraine. Before we dive into the conversation, I would love for you to tell us who you are and what your life looks like right now.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. This is such a great pleasure, and I'm just really excited to be speaking with you today. So, right now, a little bit about myself. So I'm married and have four adult children, and they are all married, and I have a total of eight, going on nine, grandkids at this moment. And we love this. Our lives are very full with our grandkids. It's really wonderful. And in fact, it's such an incredible blessing. I think now that I want to tell all newly married couples, like, just wait till your own kids grow up and have kids. It's a miracle. You know, it truly is miraculous. And God, such a gift from God. But anyway, so my husband and I are now retired, sort of semi-retired. And he's still, he has a practice. He's part-time back in counseling. So he was for many, many years, over 30 years, he was a counselor, a marriage and family therapist. And then he went to work for Catholic Charities. He was the president and CEO in our diocese. And then he retired 2 years ago, and I retired. I was working as a communication manager for a Catholic organization. And since then we've been working on books and things like that, you know. But before we retired, so this is kind of like what inspired, I don't know if you're ready for me to jump into that already, but if you want. So before we retired, we were both working, we were commuting an hour and a half each way to get to our jobs. and he had come from Los Angeles. So originally that's where he was raised. So to him, like, a long commute is just like part of life. You know, that's what they do in LA.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it's the same thing, right? Yeah, big cities. Anyway, so he was used to it. But so all our kids, though, had left home, and they're starting their own families, or they just, you know, they were gone. And we were looking around the house, and my husband says to me one day, he goes, you know, Lorraine, we only live in about 10% of this house. And he goes, and yet it's like we have this giant home that we're maintaining, and we're always fixing and cleaning and all this kind of stuff. And plus the commute. He goes, it's like we're living in a 4,000 square foot storage unit, a very well decorated storage unit, but for our kids' stuff. It was mostly our kids' stuff that was there. And as it turned out, it was stuff they didn't actually want. Because when we started, we started this process, we said, let's try living close to where we work. What would that be like? Let's sell this house, move to the town where we work, and just rent a little place for a while and just see how that would go. And so we had like 4,000 square feet. That, can you imagine the stuff? We had a ton of stuff. We had all our kids' stuff, everything. We had all my parents' stuff too, because when they passed away, I had my parents. I didn't keep everything they had, but I had a lot of it because we had a big garage, two car garage that was filled with everything but cars. And so, we had to go. We started going through all this stuff, and we were like, okay, does anybody, who wants the trophies? Who wants this wonderful furniture that, we say, you have this solid wood, bedroom set you could use for your kids now. And they're like, no, we don't want it. We don't want the trophies. Nope. You don't? You don't want any of this stuff? Nope. Anyway, so it was a huge process.
Was that rejection of all the things that you held on to, did you take that personally? Was that hard to digest? Like the fact that you've been holding on to all this stuff and they actually don't want it. Was there a sense of rejection there, or was it freedom?
Actually, it was actually a feeling of relief.
Hmm.
Yeah. Because I think I was more on the obligatory side of it. I mean, there were some things that were very precious and charming, like some little, some of the drawings, but I was thinking, I don't need files and files of, like, some people save every, drawing that their child made. But I mean, if you have multiple children, you're going to have files and files of their school papers from, different every year that they, and who knows what all. So I felt kind of liberated that I could get rid of that, okay. And the trophies too. We kind of made them save, like, if there was a really spectacular trophy, like one of my sons was like the MVP of the year for swimming or something like that. And another one was, in football had that. I'm like, just save this one, just this one trophy, but so yeah, I found it kind of freeing, but overall though, the process was really difficult because there are other things that I was attached to myself, So, yeah, it's like everybody has their own things, I think, that kind of are very, seem to have a hold. It's like there's certain objects that almost seem to have a hold on you in a sense. One of the writers that I quoted in the book was a Japanese writer who said that material things cast a spell on us. That's what he said. But in a sense, it does seem that way sometimes. That we just, but in thinking about it, I realized, it's that we are giving to these material things, these inanimate objects, we're giving them this meaning.
Mm.
We are the ones, we really hold the power, but somehow it seems like the material things have a power over us because we've allowed that to take place, Yeah.
I seem to have the opposite problem. I feel like I don't hold on to things enough. So I have six children. So I feel that I'm not holding, I don't, there's like a guilt there that I'm not treasuring little mementos.
Oh, and my gosh.
The time has passed and I was always throwing out paintings and awards and trophies. And I mean, even the other day I threw out someone's cross country medal. So I have the opposite problem where I feel that maybe I'm being too ruthless and I'm being too.
That's funny. Well, how do they feel about it? If they don't mind.
They don't mind. But well, there's mother guilt there, that mum guilt that, oh, mm-hmm. maybe I'm being too detached.
No, I think detachment is, I mean, most people, I would say you might be more unique in that most of the people that I've talked to recently, you know, as I'm doing these interviews about this book. Oh, wait, did we mention the book? I forgot to mention.
Not yet, but we will. We're going to jump right into it after this.
Oh, okay, but that's what, you know, started this process. I mean, this process started me thinking about writing a book. But anyway, so as I've been talking to people about it, it's just that a lot of people share the opposite. They tend to hoard things more than, you know, and so really they would like to be free from, and I think that's good. I find it very liberating to kind of break free from these things. And in fact, it's not the things, you know, it's like somebody will say, you know, but I can't, how can I get rid of I have my grandparents, whatever it is, you know, all this memorabilia. But it's not your actual grandparents. So, you know, it's like you still love them, and love endures, you know, even through eternity. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's really, I think it's, you know, it's sweet that you have some, you know, some people have these things that they, but you don't want to have, you know, hundreds of these things or many, you know, what, maybe one memento would be fine.
Do you think it's a generational thing?
I do.
Tended to hold on to things because of the hardships that you went through. And my generation, we haven't really experienced going without.
So yeah, right.
We're more disposable, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I really feel that, like, my kids are much less, well, I mean, overall, I would say they're more able to, they seem to embrace, or that generation, as you're saying, they seem to embrace more the idea of minimalism, let's say. Mm-hmm. I think they do appreciate that a lot more than we did. And we were all about, let's get the bigger house and the bigger house. It seemed like that, you know, we were of that kind of mentality, I guess. Or maybe it's an American thing. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's not. I just wanted to, when we say minimalism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean just have it all white and with no soul. we'll explain that a little bit later on, but I just wanted to clarify that when we're not being attached to so many things, it doesn't mean that it's soulless or doesn't have a personality. It just means it's the we're not going to be consumed by having more and more things.
Right. The overconsumption of material things. Exactly. Like, we want to detach from that. And there's, on many levels, like, so there's the spiritual level, but there's also just the practical and psychological and emotional level. Because when the neuroscience is now talking about how when the eye sees clutter, the brain shifts into problem solving mode, and that can actually, like, it pumps adrenaline into your, you know, it actually can prompt the fight or flight kind of thing, where some people can experience anxiety. So there are a lot of people who they're surrounded by clutter and they're experiencing anxiety as a result. Mm-hmm. And the average home, it said, it has 300,000 items in it. 300,000. So maybe not your home, because you throw things out, but the average home has a lot of stuff in it. And that is a lot of anxiety, or potential anxiety, mm-hmm. for the person who's dealing with all this clutter. So it's actually, on a psychological level, it's just healthier to have less stuff, but also the less stuff you have, the less, I think, the less burdened you are by material things, you know, in the gospel sense. You know, we want to be free so that we can love God, you know, love God with all our hearts and souls and mind and strength. But if we're so busy with all our stuff that we're dealing with, then we're not able to really be open to whatever it is that God wants us to do, perhaps. Like, you know, that's kind of the idea on the spiritual level.
Yeah. I mean, I even know for myself, this is on a purely cosmetic level, getting my nails done. I don't like it. I love the look of beautiful nails. Mm-hmm. I love it. And I get my nails done probably once a year. But yeah, you kind of get trapped into that cycle of maintenance, maintaining these nails. And that's time and that I don't have. And then this cycle of, oh, that's, I should go and get that done again. Or you get, and then it ruins your nails so that you want to keep that on because your nails are
right
with it on. And then there's this cycle of like, I've got to keep maintaining my fingernails.
Yeah, I know. And then you think, gosh, why am I worrying about my fingernails? Surely there's something else to do.
Exactly. Yeah. But don't get me wrong. I get nail envy because it's like, oh,
yeah, oh God,
so nice. But it's just another added burden, I think.
Yes, I think so. I think so. Yeah.
Anyway, enough about me and my nails. Let's talk about your book. It's called The Little Way of Living with Less, Learning to Let Go with the Little Flower. So I would love for you to tell us how it came about, what it's about. If we could go back to your time in Germany, because that really, I just loved that, because I found that we learn so much from being pulled out of our comfort zone.
Right.
When things get changed up, then we realize what we value, or we realize what's missing, or it just kind of shakes us up and gives us another perspective. So I would love for you to talk about that and your book if you can.
Oh, sure. Oh, gosh, that's true. Well, you're so right about getting out of our comfort zone. And that's exactly what happened to us when we went to Germany. But first, the book was, the reason I wrote the book was that I was actually looking to the little flower as somebody who could help me understand like all these virtues that she practiced to a heroic degree, how they really applied to my daily life in terms of this task of trying to detach and to live with less stuff. You know, that was the process I was going through. But so, you know, I was turning to the little flower for inspiration and guidance, actually. And she practiced these beautiful virtues of humility, trust, and simplicity, and detachment, and poverty of spirit. That's really important. She said, the only good thing is to love God with all one's heart and to stay poor in spirit. She said, that's one of her quotes, and it's just beautiful. And so she practiced that and charity, you know? So anyway, I really wanted to learn from her, and she inspired the book.
But have you always had a devotion to her, or?
Well, not always, no, but it's funny because it just sort of grew. I had read The Story of the Soul, you know, like, let's say many years ago, and the first time, I think a lot of people have this experience, the first time they read it, they kind of go, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure. And also I read a version that was not, so I read a subsequent version that was a Carmelite, really good version that was a more accurate translation. So the very first one that I read was one that had kind of, I think it was the original style that had been edited by her sisters and that had been put out. So it had a little bit of that era, the Gilded Age era, you know, that they were kind of, they kind of softened a few things in her, like, because they didn't want to offend other nuns. That was because it came out right after her death immediately. In fact, it was her obituary is what The Story of a Soul was. And because they didn't even know what to say about her, like, what, here's this, you know, this 24-year-old who died, you know, and she's, what has she done? We don't even know. So, but her sisters, of course, did, and her, you know, mother superior and them, they knew what was going on here, but the the rest of the nuns in the convent, they were all going to be shocked probably by what she was going through, you know, in her soul, internally. But at any rate, so where was I going with that? Why the state trials? Oh, yes. So then I subsequently read like the Carmelite translation, better translation, with all the notes and the letters and the, you know, all this stuff and footnotes and explanations. And I'm like, whoa, this is way more powerful than I thought, you know, so it was a lot. And every time I reread it, which was several times, it just got more, became more and more deep and profound to me. And also way harder than it initially it might seem. She has these, you know, sweet metaphors or whatever, but she's actually very, very profound and very deep, actually. So at any rate, so that's how that happened. But to go back to Germany, that was the first time that we left America. And we had our oldest was 3. And then we had another one who was a baby, he was 9 months. She had just turned 3. He was 9 months, I think. Anyway, and we landed in Germany because my husband got a job there working in mental health counseling for the military, the Americans in Germany. And then we lived in Germany because they had, we wouldn't have lived on the base because we weren't, you know, military ourselves. So we're living in this German town, this tiny little German town. And we were such fish out of water. You know, we were like your classic, I mean, I hate to say the ugly American, but yes, we probably were.
Loud American. Colorful.
We were definitely loud. And we were also clueless. Like we had no idea that the rules and regulations, the customs are entirely different. And we were violating things right and left, you know. Our kids would be noisy during the quiet time. There was a quiet time. There, you know, like a certain time in the afternoon is quiet time. And you don't, and here, you know, Americans, well, you can go, you know, play with your noisy plastic bikes in the street any time of the day or night. But there we would violate a rule.
And so, then there were so many. You cannot make noise in the street at certain times.
Yeah, it was just like certain time was quiet time. I think it was like 1 to 3 in the afternoon. All the shops would close.
Yeah.
And it was like the equivalent of a Spanish siesta. Yeah, only they didn't call it that. They didn't do that. But at any rate, we would violate that. And we would, we didn't, the, our landlord at one point, our landlord's mother, she was walking by the house from the outside. She told her son, she goes, you tell them that I can see that she didn't hem her curtains in the, I hadn't hemmed the curtains in that I hung in the kitchen window, and she could tell this from outside, you know. So they would study, you know, the mistakes that we would make. She's like, you tell her to hem her curtains. Like, oh my gosh, I don't even have a sewing machine. I can do this. I have to do it by hand. And anyway, we learned so many things. They had a great attention to detail, and they had beautiful customs for, in fact, it seemed very religious to us, like Catholic. Like there was St. Martin's Day, all the kids would go through the town and sing songs to St. Martin, and everybody carried a lantern, and the bells would ring on Christmas Eve. But it was, as we later found out, it was more of a cultural kind of a thing that they had going on rather than, you know, a deep Catholicism or anything like that. But we still loved it. It was, or St. Nicholas instead of Santa Claus. It just seemed so less materialistic also. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Santa Claus. We would go on a hike. You know, they would take the kids on a hike up this snowy mountain. We got to the top of the mountain and then we're just standing there waiting and the snow starts to fall. And then a sleigh comes out of the woods and there's St. Nicholas. You know, and he's like wishing everybody, you know, Merry Christmas or whatever he said. Anyway, so like beautiful things, like they were not just not like all about like rushing off to, you know, Toys R Us to buy large quantities of toys. Yeah. That was They didn't do that at all. So it was.
They still had like a sense of wonder.
Yes.
Like wonder.
That's true. Yeah. Very true. Yeah. And it just was the first time we kind of were shaken up. We realized it was like, you know, feeling like we were pilgrims on earth, which we are. But it was the first kind of awareness that I had of that. And it kind of made us really relish our faith more. Actually, yeah. So it brought us closer to the church because, you know, the local chaplain was, you know, very attentive to his, you know, his parishioners who were all, you know, everybody is, you know, Americans from, you know, there. He was trying to really bring us together in a community, and it was beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to establish communities.
Yeah.
Traditional communities.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
It's so important. We have lost our village, so to speak.
Yeah.
In raising our families, in our faith journey, yes, as well. We need each other. Like, you can't do it alone.
Right. Exactly. That's so true. In these sprawling suburbs, that's kind of part of, you know, what we were kind of made aware of too. Mm-hmm. Going to Germany, you just go, they're tiny little villages and everybody knows everybody, you know, and it's just like, it was really, really sweet. And to come from, you know, America is like all about these, you know, it's just like driving everywhere, giant suburbs. And, you know, your kids don't really even, it's sad the way we've lost that, the like what you said, community, but, you know, we no longer live near the kids don't have their grandparents nearby because everybody's all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you have to drive them to school and you have to drive them to, their football practice, and you have to drive them to whatever, you know, baseball or whatever you do, and drive them to see friends. And yeah, it seems like we've developed our life around, you know, just, I don't know what it is, but not a community.
Yeah.
And so that's what we have to kind of strive to keep that or to create that, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking about the hemming of the curtains.
Oh, yeah.
You think it's more not that she's hung up on the fact that you haven't hemmed your curtains and they look dreadful, more to the fact that these need to last, you need to take care of them, you need to kind of make sure that they're hemmed so that they last longer rather than nitpicking that they look ugly?
Yeah, I don't really know. I think it was they just had an amazing attention to detail, and they did, probably lasting longer is something because the houses were made incredibly well. So the house we lived in, one of them, well, we lived in two separate places. So the first one was a little quaint farmhouse, which was, which turned out to be dreadful.
A farmhouse. But
yeah, it was a farmhouse, and it wasn't like, at first I'm like, oh, cool, a farmhouse, you know, but then it turned out to be like really like a farmhouse. Like there were animals and there were flies and there was mosquito, there was bugs and there were fleas, and we were in, you know, we had a flea infestation. But anyway, so aside from that, the second house was built by our German landlord, and this thing was magnificently built. Like, oh, the 2 foot wall wide brick kind of, you know, walls all around, airtight, beautifully made, really. But so to your point, probably the Germans do, they not only have an attention to detail, but they also do, you know, things do last. You buy one sofa and it lasts forever, you know, and here we're always doing these, you know, we buy something cheap and throw it out and start over.
So what did you take away from being pulled out of your comfort zone and being thrown into this very ordered, tight-knit, sounds like, community? Did you realize that you missed the States, or it?
Well, we did. We did miss. At first, after the culture shock, we did eventually really just want to go back to the States just to feel more comfortable, you know, be at home. But the thing that I think the most profound lesson was really that, well, I learned that not everybody, first of all, don't assume that everybody in the world thinks exactly the same way you do. You know, it's like, I think, and it's kind of like, you know this, you know that other people have, for example, different personalities or whatever, but still, because of original sin, we tend to, I think, judge people harshly when they react differently than we would. You know, and so, and we just assume, we make this assumption that everybody should respond the way we respond. And that's just, I think, original sin. Because we, if intellectually everybody knows, we, you know, if you, I point that out to you, say, of course, but yet on a day-to-day level, we do react badly and we, we harshly judge other people all the time, you know, anyway. So I got a real lesson in, wow, things can be very, very different than you think. You know, it's not always the way I see, the way I see things may not be the way another part of the world sees it. So, you know, don't like try to set aside those preconceptions. But the second thing, and the more important, I think, was that I started to reflect on the spiritual journey that we're all on. And that is that we, this isn't our home. And we keep kind of trying to make it, it's our temporary home, and we are supposed to appreciate it and love it. I mean, what God has given us, these beautiful gifts of where we live, what our home is, let's say, you know, and that's wonderful. That's beautiful. Like, so we each have our own, you know, we feel drawn to, of course, our native home. And we are also drawn to create a home where we are, where we live, and for our family, and all this, and to try to make it beautiful, and to use God's beautiful gifts that He's given us. And this is all wonderful, but we're not supposed to become so attached to them that we can't let go if He needs us to do that, you know. And we are also, most importantly, called to remember that we are on a journey to our true home. So it, we can lose sight of that. We can lose sight of the fact that we're ultimately drawn, we are called to heaven, to be with God, you know, forever, in for eternity, as part of, you know, in just to be a part of the unity of the Trinity and His immense love for all of creation, every single one, you know, for all of creation, every single person, and we're all called to be one. But in the meantime, we're here. So it's like, we sometimes tend to lose, we forget that we're on this journey. Mm-hmm. And then we get overly attached to where we are. And I think that, and then I think that's why God does these things sometimes, like shakes us up a little, you know, like, you know, lets us have a you know, something to disrupt the comfort, you know. Yeah. Because then what happens is that we might, instead of looking to God for our, you know, for really, instead of realizing that God is going to be the source of our ultimate happiness, you know, we start placing our happiness into things or into proxies for things. Like we might say, you know, I have to be surrounded by enough material things so that I feel like I'm secure, you know, I got it because I need security. But you know, where is our security ultimately coming from? It's coming, really, our security is going to come from God, but we misplace that trust and then we start placing it in things. Or sometimes it could be we're placing it in we need power or we need control. Mm. You know, sometimes it's different for different people. But when we become anxious and distressed, we start turning to these other things other than God. And I think He wants us to always remember that to turn to Him and to place our trust in Him. And that's one of the messages of Saint Therese. Like she 100%, you know, trust her trust was in God. She had, you know, so much confidence, and she totally surrendered to him. And that was one of the reasons she became a great saint, was this incredible trust and confidence and surrender to God. And that's kind of what we're trying to learn here as well.
So how did that journey start for you when when you realized that you were living in a glorified shipping container? Or
oh, yes.
let's start to cull. Where do you go? What do you do?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, well, actually, it's so funny because at first I was overvaluing all my things, right? So I had to detach. And part of the way it sort of happened naturally would be I would say, okay, I'd try to give this stuff to the kids. Okay, first the kids, oh, they don't want it. Okay, fine. Okay, you don't want it. You sure you don't want it? It's solid wood. No. Okay. And so then it would be, so I'll put it on Facebook Marketplace we had a garage sale or whatever, you know, and you put a price tag on some stuff and people will be like, I'll give you maybe, you know, $50 for that. No, or whatever. And you're like, what? And so, and that's where you get a little offended because, you know, oh, this was my prized possession here, you know.
You're growing in the virtue of humility very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you realize that they're not going to pay what you think it's, you always overvalue your own things. Anyway, so I finally had to realize, and actually it was kind of a moment, it was really kind of cool because I had this one, there was just one transaction where this family came over and they needed a bedroom set for their kids. And so they came over, they said, will you take this? And the price kept going lower and lower. And they're standing there and I look at them and it's a sweet little, you know, immigrant family that had like three or four little kids, you know, and I'm like, you know what? I was thinking in my mind, I was like, yeah, they should have all of this. And let's throw in the, you know, I started throwing in stuff with, I'm like, you know, you're right. You should have it because I had the moment of clarity. We did use it. We used our stuff. We got the value out of it. Our kids used it. Now it's time for them to have it. You know, they need, and so if they can't afford it, let's give it to them, whatever they can afford, you know. And then at that point, I started practically giving stuff away. So it was because I finally realized that somebody else is going to love and appreciate the stuff that I can't use now. So anyway, it was good. It was like a feeling of, you know, much more feeling of community, I guess. You know, like I can help out the community here in this small way. But yeah, it was funny because I had to go through that process of, you know, starting out way up here thinking my stuff is so valuable, you know, and then going down and realizing it's really not that valuable.
Yeah. It's also giving you a moment, a connection, like we're wired for each other and you're able to connect with them in a real tangible way. And that's what sustains us more than things, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. So right.
So, so beautiful.
Yeah. You know, it was something, but it was also very stressful, just like the whole thing, you know? So it was stressful and I realized like, wow, I've got to grow in virtue. And that's when I was thinking of Saint Therese and all the virtues she practiced. Like I need to like start practicing some of these, you know, I need to
grow. Much harder said than done. I mean,
yeah.
Much harder done than said.
Yeah, exactly. Harder done than said. Exactly. Yeah. So true. Yeah. But yeah, that's, and each chapter in the book, so each chapter has a different virtue that Saint Therese practiced. So they're the virtues, as I mentioned, like humility, trust, detachment, simplicity, poverty of spirit. So each chapter has a virtue, but also what I have, I teamed up with a friend who is a professional organizer, because I'm not a professional organizer. She's a declutterer too. And so she has a business, and so she contributed a little a tip for each chapter. So a tip on, you know, what a professional would do. So like, you know, she has a tip on decluttering. She said clutter is actually a visual representation of delayed decision making.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, you just have to take action. You know, what's this thing doing here on the table? You know, where does it go? Put it away. And anyway, so she has a little tip for each chapter and it's really great. Yeah.
You say that again. Clutter is actually a visual representation
of delayed decision making.
Yeah. Well, I've got a few delayed decision making children.
Yeah. But that's what it is. It's like, why does there's always a place in your house that like it attracts, like it's like a hot spot, you know, and there's piles of paper. It's like, where does all this paper come from? Why do we have to?
Some people think that cleaning is just moving one thing, you know, so one set of papers to another horizontal ledge.
Yes, right.
Relocating. You're not actually putting it away. Exactly. You're just moving it to a different eye level. And that's not helpful.
No, or also like there's a huge business, you know, $1 million of business of creating organizing things, you know, organizers, like little, like things you can buy and you think, well, I got to go to, you know, the container store and buy, you know, containers for all my things, you know, and that's just putting the clutter into containers and then putting the containers somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not deep. You know, it's not getting rid of it, which you probably need to do.
It's just storing it neatly.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow. I what was the hardest thing to get rid of, like to be detached from?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had one thing that was, so we had an Amish farmhouse table, and like a beautiful cherry table. So really big that everybody could fit around. We had all the Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners, you know, around this table, with a little, and it has a little matching hutch, you know, that we had, and it required a very large dining room, which we had in the big house. And then this is the house that the kids grew up in, right? Big house. And so I had imbued it with all these memories, right? You know, it's all in the, so all the, and also the potential for all the future Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners, you know, that I envision, you know, everybody, you know, so it has like, there's this huge
fabricated kind of idea of
my imagination, actually. No, but because in reality, when your kids grow up and they move away, or they don't move away, but they can't all, not everybody's going to be able to come back and all have dinner at your place, you know, at your farmhouse table, you know, and on into eternity, you know, at my house. But at any rate, I had this table and it was very hard. So we moved. So remember I was mentioning, we decided to live in a little place, little townhome that was close to where we worked. We rented this place. Well, anyway, so we have all the stuff that I kept, all of our essentials plus things that I hadn't been able to let go of yet. So including this table and all the chairs. So the movers come in and they're like, this table doesn't fit in the dining, in the new place, you know, the place you're moving into. I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like trying to squeeze. It does not, it's bigger than this room. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to keep it. So I took it all apart, disassembled it, and I stored it under our bed. So I shoved it under the bed. And this thing is sitting under the bed, not being used, gathering dust and messing with the feng shui of the of the room, you know.
And go on it as you hopped into bed every night.
I know, right? Exactly. Stubbed my toe on it. And so I was telling the story to a friend, and he goes, He's like, well, that's really easy. Why don't you just give it away? Why don't you give it to one of your kids? What? Why are you hanging on to this thing? And I'm like, what? That's easy for you to say. Yeah. I was like so insulted. And I was so mad about it. But then I thought about it. I'm like, you know, he is right. It's not being used. And it's all in my imagination, this potential use. And or in the past, my memories, which are lovely, but that's not here and now. And so I did. I asked my son and daughter-in-law, and they have four kids. So I'm like, do you guys need a table? Maybe you need this one. And they're like, sure, we'll take it. So they took that. Yeah, because that was a nice, yeah, it's a good table. And it needs a large family, so it didn't need just my husband and myself. So anyway, so that was hard for me.
Not only did you let go of it, but you still get to use it.
That's true. We still get to
sit around it. You still get to enjoy those thoughts that you thought you were going to have with family, just not in your home. Yeah.
Exactly. No, that's so true. That's right. That's exactly what I was trying to.
Get to achieve what you thought was going to happen at that table, just not under your roof. So that's
exactly. And it's also, but it's also a lesson too, because one of the things that I think we have to let go of, and I think it can happen to older people, like I think my age, you know, I think. And there's a temptation to want to control too much, you know? And I think it's like another lesson of learning that's something we have to let go of.
Yeah.
You know, not always try to be in control of everything. You have to hand the baton on. You know, it's like we have to realize when your kids are older that they are now adults and that they're making wise decisions and they're raising their kids, you know? And sometimes it's hard for, you know, people who are grandparents. So in fact, my husband was just telling me that he read a study. I think it was a sociological study that said that 75% of all grandparents think that their own kids are not raising their kids as well as they raised them.
Yeah.
Like in other words, don't think that the great, you know, so we're, all the older generations are judging harshly the younger ones. So it's just like a perennial problem. But I think, yeah, so we should be on guard against that, you know, as we get older.
Yeah. Sorry, a fighter jet just flew over. Did you hear that?
Oh, no, I didn't hear a thing.
Oh, just as well. It was, that's
was
very,
it really loud?
Very unusual for you. So no. I don't know what that was about. Anyway. So true. No, that's so true. I also heard or I read last week the, you know, judging other, your children, you know, I wouldn't have done it like that, or I was a much better parent, or, you know, she's too lenient on her children, or a good mother knows how to nurture and mother and then to let go at the right time.
Right.
Like that's you can start that process with your things.
Yes, exactly.
And they're probably there so we can learn that lesson quite naturally and gently and then be able to do that with our children.
Yes.
We can't hold on.
Right.
We have to let them go. And that doesn't mean we don't love them or love the nice things. It just means that there is a natural process of letting go.
Exactly. No, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm trying to find it. I've just pulled the book out. You probably hear me turning pages, but.
Oh, that's okay.
I can't seem to find it. But I just
one of the things that always bothered me with some people are like, they would demand that they're it was like my parents. So I feel like my parents set an example because they said, so for example, they didn't demand that we bring the grandkids, their grandkids to their house for Christmas, like you know, important holidays like that, like drive all the way. They said, look, you establish your own tradition. You now are raising a family. You stay home. Your kids want to be home on Christmas and open their presents or whatever, you know, so you go ahead and do that. We'll come to you if we can, you know? And so, and I always thought that is so, that's so wise. So I always thought about that. And I noticed there's a lot of people who don't do that. Like they require their kids and the grandkids to come to them, like, and to travel with at great discomfort to the everybody involved.
Yeah.
And what is that about? I think that's part of what you just mentioned. It's not letting go and letting them then take off in their own, you know, their own family, like have their own traditions, their own establishing their own.
Hmm.
I'm not against like being together as a family. I'm just saying, why wouldn't they? It's easier for, we're the ones, we can go to their house. They're the ones that have, you know, what are they going to, you know, drag the baby out on a cold and snowy day to travel, you
what
know,
day over here.
Yeah. This, you know what I mean? Or whatever.
I found it says here, this is in, Do You Know Theology of the Home by Carrie Gress and Noel Merritt.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I do.
So this is in their second one, their second book, and they say here, we can see that the healthy mother or the good woman is the one right in the middle who understands the balance of tending to and letting go of her children.
Yeah.
Through her years of care, this mother knowingly works herself out of a job.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, and I thought, well, when you were speaking,
That's it, exactly.
We're given that those opportunities to learn this process through letting go of our things, not
right.
Without our things, but it gives us an easier way to learn how to let go.
Yes, yeah, that's a really good point. Yes, and it really helps. I think it helps the kids too. Like I was thinking of, so our one of the examples we give in the book, or I give in the book, is of our daughter and son-in-law, and she's rather a minimalist in the sense that, not in the sense of everything white, as you said, but in the sense of having fewer things. And so they have right now, they have, their youngest is not, it's like a year and a half, and there's the older one is three. And they're, so they have very few toys. So she just doesn't allow a lot of stuff in the house. And she also doesn't have, she has, you know, very minimal kitchen appliances and whatnot. She just has whatever you need to cook, not a bunch of stuff. Like some people have to have every kitchen gadget, right? But no, she's just got like frying pan and, you know, she's got basic stuff. But anyway, the kids, and the thing, we were just there visiting them, and it's so cute. They just have such imaginations. Like they don't even they're not playing with toys. They'll read books, but they don't have toys around. So they'll make up their little games. They'll make up games and or they'll go outside and just, you know, pick up branches of, you know, trees, or in, you know, just pretend it's a sword or whatever. They're very imaginative.
Mm. And there's that I follow on Instagram, and she's Ballerina Farm, and she has seven little kids, and she cooks these amazing meals. And
yes,
but she has two pots. She uses the same kind of spatula for pretty much everything. She doesn't have a lot of stuff.
Yes, I follow her too.
They manage so much better than people that have every kitchen gadget. And I mean, yes, she does know how to cook. Like she is a natural in the kitchen.
Oh yeah.
But you don't need all those things. You just,
right.
It just shows you that you don't need a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They've got siblings and they have a lot of chores to do, so they're always busy, but her house is very minimal. Like it's always impressed me, the fact that they don't have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they manage just fine, actually. Yes. Better than fine.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it is so true, so true.
So do you miss any of your stuff? Have you given stuff away and thought, oh, I wish I had that?
I think in the whole time that I've gone through all these things, there's probably only one thing that I wish that I saved. And it wasn't mine. It was something of my mom's. It was something that she painted and hand painted thing. And I saved many of her things, but there was one thing and that I probably should have saved. And she was a painter, and I have a gazillion of her paintings. So, you know, I'm very happy with all those things. But she also painted like boxes and things like that, and painted, you know, furniture. She did little anyway. But yeah, there was one thing that she had that I probably should have saved as a, you know, cause it would have been useful. It was a box that she put her jewelry in. It was a jewelry box. Yeah. And at the time I'm like, who uses jewelry boxes? I don't use a jewelry box, you know? So I didn't keep it. And anyway, but I feel a little bit sad about that. But literally, like, if you think about how many things I've gone through and gotten rid of, there's one thing, you know, it's really only one thing.
Yeah. And the person that has that,
they're very happy. Yeah. You know, they appreciated it. So.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. I think I might, maybe I did say I don't have much clutter. I don't, and I get rid of a lot of stuff. But one thing I do have, which I really need to process, are my clothes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't, because I wear the same things all the time, but I have a cupboard of clothes that I think one day I might wear that. That
yes.
was expensive. I should keep it, or my daughters might want it.
I have the same problem. I was realizing that just the other day myself. I was like, I literally wear the same things every single day.
I mean,
a variety, but like we're talking, yeah, you know, maybe four or five things, you know, it's not yeah. like.
And you put it back on again and you think, before I had this.
Yeah, I know, right? I know. I have like this black t-shirt and I was like, well, gosh, that's all I wear. I always wear a black t-shirt, or sometimes I wear a white t-shirt. Yeah. You know, it's not like I have what do I need all these other things for?
No. Yeah. The games we play in our mind. I think it comes from being a mother. So you have clothes before you were pregnant.
Oh yeah.
Pregnancy clothes, breastfeeding clothes, after having a baby.
Right.
Then,
and also because your weight fluctuates the whole time.
Exactly right. You have to wear certain clothes at certain times. Yeah. And then doing that 6-7 times,
right,
you hold on to them because you're going to use it again when you have that next child. I think I just need to move on now. I'm 47 almost. I don't think I'm having any more.
Oh. Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. It is hard, I think, as for women, I think, probably more so than, and it's funny because there's a Instagrammer that I follow who's a minimalist, you know, anyway, and she was describing, she said, sometimes you can go too far. So she actually did the thing where she threw out everything other than what she wore. And she always wears like a pair of jeans, a t-shirt. And I'm like, yes, that's me. And she goes, well, what happened was she had to go to a funeral and it was it was on short notice, and she literally she said she had no dresses. So she had to go in wearing, she had to find a, she put on a nice pair of jeans, but she was like, oh my gosh, I have nothing. And so maybe I went too far, she said. So yeah, keep your one nice black dress, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, always have a black dress and then you're good.
yeah All right, well, I'm going to go and do that.
Okay. Yeah.
Can I just ask one question, just one more before we go? You said that your husband is a marriage and counseling therapist. This is just for the ladies out there.
Yeah.
Do you find that there is pressure to have a perfect marriage because of that?
Wait, to have a perfect marriage, so, because...
So do you, your husband is a marriage and counseling therapist.
Oh, because he's a marriage and family therapist.
Yeah.
Now.
Is there?
You mean me?
Yeah. Do you find that there's a little bit of pressure there that you've got to have it all together because?
No, not at all. Actually, but I'm just like he's constantly learning and because you have to keep up your CEUs and all that kind of stuff, you know, continuing it and all. He's always very inspiring. So, I mean, I've learned so much. So I feel like we're always doing better because he has the wisdom that he's from his experience. So like he'll, you know, whatever it is that he's learned, whether it's a communication, you know, technique or something, he'll share it with me, or if it could be any number of things. And I'm like, wow, this is so helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I'm becoming a better spouse because, you know, I can learn from him, which is, you know, so I mean, that doesn't mean that I put into practice all the time the things he's you know, knows about it, or he doesn't always put them into practice either, because, you know, like we'll have an argument or whatever. But I feel like we're always on it's I don't feel a pressure from outside, because I don't feel anybody's like pointing their finger at us or anything like that. But yeah, I think that it's been really helpful for our marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, right. Yeah.
Wonderful. Lorraine, it was so lovely chatting with you this morning. Well, your evening.
Yeah.
Keep going, I am sure. But to wrap this up, I always ask my guests something that has brought them joy this week. So is there anything that has brought you joy this week?
Yeah. Well, this week, we just came back from our we've spent some time with our grandkids. So, and also we have grandkids that live really close to us here. So we have 4, 5 going on 6 grandkids that live right nearby, within 10 minutes of our house. And we've spent some time with them, and every time I spend with them, it's a delight. But then we just came back from visiting our daughter and son-in-law who live in Texas. So there, we hadn't gotten to see them for a while, you know, and just seeing how they grow and change and how delightful they are is just so, it's such a joy that really is, brings, you know, warmth to my heart. So it's just, they're amazing little people. And it's just like, it's amazing that God allows us to see this, to have this opportunity to see our own kid. I mean, it's because I can still remember them as babies. You know, I remember my kids when they were babies, and then to see, and sometimes you get the flash, the glimpse of the grandchild that you can see the resemblance, you know, you might see it in the eyes or in a look or a phrase that they have. And it's always fun and just amazing, and makes me think of, you know, makes me feel grateful to God for that. Yeah.
Beautiful. A lady I work with, we have a daughter the same age, and she just became a grandmother this week. So yeah. It's so very real. Like, I could be a grandmother in the next few years. This could be interesting.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic.
What a gift.
Yes, it is.
Well, it was a joy to speak with you. Where can people find your book?
Well, they can go to sophiainstitute.com. That's where my book is, and some other books that I've written as well, or my husband and I have written together. And yeah, so sophiainstitute.com, also Amazon. Yeah.
Okay. And I'm pretty sure there's the Cardinal Newman Center here in Sydney will also stock your book as well.
Oh, that would be lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. All right, Lorraine, thank you. Go and enjoy all those grandbabies.
Yes.
And thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It's been so wonderful talking with you. Yeah.
It was fun. You're the Maria Kondo before her time.